The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. On Sunday, I uploaded an interview with Yasin Kakande, wherein I stepped in and offered paraphrased narration because I thought that the audio quality on his side of the conversation, combined with his accent, made his side difficult to follow. However, having listened to the conversation with earbuds, I find Kakande's answers come through clearly, and this week I'm uploading the full conversation, a conversation I'd shortened because of the time required to edit in unnecessary narration. Kakande is a former journalist for the newspaper The National out of Dubai, a news producer for City 7 TV in Dubai, and a former reporter and assistant editor for the Bahrain Tribune. His book, Slave States, is out from Zero Books this month. It is an expose of the kafala system. Kafala is a sponsorship system used to monitor migrant workers in the Gulf Arab region. Kafala requires that a migrant worker's employer acts as his or her sponsor. It puts the employer in charge of most aspects of a migrant worker's life. The human rights organization Amnesty International has documented many human rights abuses by kafala employers. It's Wednesday, December 16, 2015, and I'm Douglas Lane, the host of this podcast and the publisher of Zero Books. I should also say that Yasin Kakande is a writer who I'm very proud to have published. His first book, The Ambitious Struggle, got him fired from The National and deported from the UAE, from Dubai. And we're very proud to publish his second book, which we hope will cause him far less trouble. The music you're listening to right now is Bach's Goldberg Variations. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Yasin Kakande discussing his book, Out from Zero, entitled Slave States. Let me start by just asking you about your first book, which was entitled The Ambitious Struggle. What was that book about, and what were the consequences of its publication?
My first book was actually about my life. It was like an autobiography. I was telling my life and the lives of other people whom I had interacted with, mostly migrants in the Arab world. I concentrated most of the life in Dubai, the UAE, and it touches a number of things, including the media censorship, because I was working in a newspaper, I was working in a television. So I encountered several instances of censorship, and it was part of my autobiography. It discusses about racism, and as an African migrant, of course, racism is an issue in the UAE and in most of the Gulf Arab countries. And it also discusses about the migrants' rights and the migrants' problems in the UAE. As a migrant still, I had an entitlement to discuss migrant issues. And what really happened after the publication of the book was that at first they did not care so much about the book. For about 6 months, no one asked me anything about the book. And suddenly my editor-in-chief in the Abu Dhabi media called me and told me that the book had offended the company and the country. He told me that I had 1 month to leave the country, and I had to go out. That was the end. The book was responded with anger from the authorities in the UAE, and it led to my expulsion from the UAE till now. So that was my first book, The Ambitious Struggle.
And just out of curiosity, where was that published?
The Ambitious Struggle was published in Florida by Florida Academic Press in the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
They wouldn't allow the book to be read in the UAE, is that correct?
That is correct, actually. A couple of people, even though for the last 6 months they were not doing anything or telling me anything, still the books that were coming into the country were being confiscated. Actually, all the books that even we ordered through Amazon were all always being confiscated. There was one bookstore which managed to bring in one copy of the book, and after finding out that it could bring in copies, then we started going there to make orders. At first, they took the orders, and afterwards, they told us that the orders had come at the airport, and they had confiscated the books, and they told them that this book was banned in the UAE. So the book was not allowed to come into the UAE, and it was not also... And the author was also not allowed to stay in the UAE after its publication.
Your dismissal from the National, that didn't really come from the newspaper alone. That came from the state? That came from the UAE?
Yes, my dismissal from the National newspaper did not come from the newspaper. Actually, what happened is that the editor of the National who dismissed me had not even read the book. And all the people who sat on the panel that dismissed me, no one had even read the book. So it was very clear, and as they mentioned that the book had offended the country and the company, it was very clear that they had got orders from outside.
What is the official policy of the UAE when it comes to freedom of the press? Was this a corrupt move or was it legal?
I don't think it was a correct move. On paper, they have a lot of color about the acceptance of criticism, the freedom of speech and everything. But in reality, what is going on the ground is that the UAE is a police state that is imprisoning people because of their ideas. My case for dismissal and deportation is even softer compared to the other cases of people who have been arrested because of their ideas, just putting up a post on Twitter, just only 140 words, and you get in your life fully interrupted, and you are imprisoned, you disappear. So it's not an isolated case, my case, and it is an issue that is very much rooted into the UAE authorities.
What accounts for your treatment? What protected you? Was it who was publishing you or the language it was published in?
I have a feeling that it could have been worse even in my case. They could have arrested me, harassed me, or even made me disappear. One of the things that protected me was that the book was not popular itself. Because it was in English, very few Arabs had read the book, and even on the international scale, it did not go so far. So not the people who read the book, they thought that they could handle it with silence. They could just dismiss me and expel me from the country, and that would be the end. Everyone will forget about the book and will forget about me. That was the strategy.
Now you're publishing a second book with us, with Zero Books. What is your circumstance now? Where are you employed, and are you concerned about present circumstances when this book comes out in December?
Actually, right now I'm not employed. I'm not concerned about the circumstances, even though I have always done. What happens is that after the first circumstance, after the first book, I learned so much. And one of the things I learned is that mostly what they can do to you is to expel you, to have you deported out of the country. So I deported myself from the Arab country where I finished this book before they could deport me. I left the country in May. Was it in May? Yes, after I had signed a deal with Zero Books to publish this book. Mm-hmm. I expelled myself, and currently I'm just doing my own work. I do some freelance writing, and I am mostly into my own small firm. Mm-hmm. just about 2-3 acres. So this is what is taking my time. So I'm not afraid about anything this time or over, because I think that I have learned from the previous book what is always the consequences of publishing a book in a police state.
You do say it's the greatest insult to Islam.
Yes, that is the first title, actually. That is right. I'm saying that it's the greatest insult for Islam because of its inhuman treatment of human beings. It's inhuman treatment. It's discrimination policy towards migrants. Islam is a religion that welcomed migrants. The first Muslims, the Prophet himself, was a migrant, and he was welcomed in Medina. The kafala system, that institutionalizes discrimination and mistreatment of migrants, is an Islamic. It's a very big insult. I also look at Islam as a religion of most of the migrants who are going to these Arab countries. They have a feeling that in these countries, the birthplace of Islam, they would have comfort. They will have the same treatment that the earlier migrants of Islam received. Unfortunately, this is contrary. They are rejected and they are mistreated once they arrive in these countries. This region is a region where it's the most focal region about Islam. Thousands of Muslims every day, and while facing facing the Kaaba, which is in this region, even the people who are buried, when we are setting off our dear ones, the dead people, we make them face in this region. So to find that in this region there is a mistreatment of human beings on a large scale like this, it's appalling. It's very bad.
How did kafala come to be, and what is the original aim of that policy? What
kafala actually initially it is from the roots of the Arab people for taking care of their visitors. Actually, it is supposed to take care of visitors, not to mistreat them. Mm-hmm. It means to take care itself. The word means itself, to take care. Initially, when the Arabs had visitors, they would put the visitors in their care. Now what is happening today is that kafala, it's the same as sponsorship. When you have a kafala, a kafir, who is your sponsor, he has full control of you. He's not just taking care of you, but he will just exploit you. Whatever you need to do, whatever you need to get to attain, you need his permission. You need his permission to get a driving license. You need his permission to change the job. He's your employer, but you need his permission to change the job. Mm-hmm. You need his permission to get married. You need his permission to do anything, actually. It is kind of enslavement. And when it comes to some workers, like especially domestic workers who are isolated into their houses and everything, this kind of isolation and this kind of complete dependence on the sponsor, it breeds a lot of abuses, and there is impunity for the employer or the sponsor. When he abuses you, he has impunity with this system, because there is no equality between the sponsor and the person who is being sponsored, the migrant, whether it is in the law or it is in the courts of law or everywhere. So you find even that some cases of abuses even go unreported, because these people, if you are a migrant and you report to your sponsor, the first thing is you lose your status as a migrant. You have to be deported because you will not have a sponsor. And the only way you can stay in this country is by having a sponsor who is an Arab or a job that is owned by an Arab citizen. So this is the instance.
Who can be a sponsor of a foreign worker in the UAE, for instance? You said it's usually the worker's employer that is the sponsor under this system. Is that always the case?
Yeah, that is almost always the case. The employer is supposed to be the sponsor. In most cases, still, the Arab citizens, they are entitled to sponsor people. And and even if they are not the employer or what, they are entitled to sponsor a certain number of people. The policy differs from country to country in the Gulf. Mostly it's the employer that is your sponsor, but every job, of course, every employment, it's not so much that it has some Arab behind it. So in for every citizen, for every migrant, there is always an Arab citizen behind. Whether it is a big corporation or what, there is always an Arab migrant behind this institution. Parents can also sponsor their children, but that is until they are 18 years. Once they are 18 years, then they have to lose the parental sponsorship and they have to find an Arab sponsor or something like unemployment or job.
If you had brought your son or daughter to the UAE, you would be their sponsor until they turned 18.
That is right. For the case of the girl, until they get married, it is not always that they have to get married at 18 in the Arab sense.
How many workers in the UAE are part of the kafala system? And to what extent does the UAE rely on sponsored migrant workers to run their economy?
There is no clear estimate of how many workers, but the estimates say that almost 80% of the people staying in the UAE are foreigners. That is, they are all being sponsored by the 20% citizens. So most of the people in the UAE and most of the people in Qatar also itself, they are mostly foreigners. It is only Saudi Arabia, I think, and Oman, which would have the majority of its citizens as local citizens. But in the other Arab countries, it's mostly foreigners who are the majority. And these foreigners are always being sponsored by the citizens.
Once you're there and you're living under a sponsor, is there a physical divide? I mean, do you live amongst Arabs in a regular way, side by side, or do you have your own area that you would live in, or how does that work?
It works differently to people working like domestic workers and to other professions working outside. For domestic workers, of course, if it is a maid or a driver, they always have their different quotas in the Arab system, in the Arab homes. It is very popular that you find them, even when they are going out on outings, they are putting in very drastic clothes that distinguishes or that discriminates them from the family. And to other workers, especially those are being sponsored by the companies, still you find that the discrimination is there on where they are staying. They are being housed mostly in industrial areas or in other labor camps that are scrumpy and that are very dirty and hygienic. So the discrimination is still there when it comes to housing. They have places allocated for only the local citizen Arabs, and they always have a cover that they call it for family. And having that, most of the workers in these countries, they are by law not allowed to have families because the law requires them to have a sizable income to have their own wives into the country. So they are by law forbidden from having families. So they have nowhere else to stay other than in these big areas, scrumpy and very dirty and unhygienic areas.
There's a whole chapter in your book about sexual starvation and the way the sponsors sort of regulate the intimate personal lives of the workers, forbidding young women to get married. And also, if you are married, they will forbid you from bringing your spouse.
That's right. Yes. Actually, I have dedicated a full chapter on sexual starvation because it is an issue in all these Gulf Arab countries. It is an issue for the migrant workers themselves who are being shipped into these countries on a daily basis. And it is also an issue even on the Arabs themselves, where policies of discrimination is institutionalized. For the migrant workers, it is that for anyone to sponsor a wife, they have to earn a sizable income, which is always very large. You find that it's not only the construction workers or the people working in the low places that cannot afford the wives, but even professional people who are working in big companies who are working as professionals, as medical doctors, as engineers, even as journalists. They are not allowed to have wives because they have an income that is less than the designated income. I myself, when I worked in the UAE, at least for two jobs, I worked as the reporter for the Gulf Today, which is Dar al-Khalij. I was not allowed to have a wife because the salary was low, was not low compared to the stipulated one. Still, when I worked in Qatar, still my salary was low. What they did in Qatar was that once you propose that you want to have your wife here and you do the paperwork, then they will do what? Then they will increase your salary to that salary that is allowed for someone to bring in his wife. It was very, very funny. But still, they will have a lot of roadblocks for you for bringing a wife or a spouse into Qatar. One of the roadblocks was that the wife also had to, that the person who is bringing in the wife had to be, have a degree, at least a university degree or a higher degree diploma. You know, it is very funny that when they are giving you a job, they don't ask for these qualifications. But when you are bringing in a wife, then they want only degree holders to enjoy the company of the women. It's very funny. It was ridiculous. It is an issue that is not hidden in the UAE or Qatar, that when you go through these cities, when you go through most of the migrant areas, the signs of people being sexually starved are so much visible. Just if when you have a woman in the car and you are traveling through this Sonapur labor camps, you'll see heads turning at every point because these people, they would have you having something in the car that is coming from the heaven. So, and it's not only that, you will find that I am just quoting in the book an instance in 1 month where we reported several cases of abuses, sexual abuses, and also of men filming women in toilets, in laboratories, and everywhere, because it's all part of the sexual starvation that these men are enduring, that they have to go to these higher levels of to satisfy themselves. I also have to noted in the book about how this trend is leading to a lot of homosexuality and other sexual diversions. Still just because of these restrictions for people to live a married life with their spouses.
It seems to me that if people are opting for homosexuality to solve the problems of sexual starvation under these circumstances, that they're running quite a risk. I mean,
of course, homosexuality is illegal in these countries, but it is being condoned through the system of restricting people to live a married life with their wives. When you go to these labor camps, still you'll find so many stories of people who thought that who thought that earlier that they were straight, but they turned homosexual because they had that was the only practice into the labor camps. That was the only way. When you are living with a fellow man, when you are a man living with a fellow man, it is something that is that will not raise alarms and. Something that is not so much until it is noticed that it will not be an issue. And even in countries where they will stop you when you are having a woman in the car to ask you whether you are married or you have a marriage certificate, it is also very common. In Sharjah, there was a time when they started even going to doors knocking to ask you whether people who are living in those houses, they are really married. But when you are living with a man, still when they find you a man inside the house and all the people inside their men, then they will not have a quarrel. They will just have to leave.
Well, let's talk about Harriet. You mentioned a woman who came to you looking for work. This is part of your book. And
yes,
she was not unemployed, or was she unemployed at that point when she came to you?
She was employed when she came to me, actually, but she wanted to change her job, actually. Someone had told her that because I was a professional journalist there, that I could easily find her a better job. Her problem was that actually she was educated. She had a higher diploma, and she had worked in a professional arena as a photographer and as a photo manager for a company in Uganda. So now what she was doing a cleaning job in the UAE. she had been deceived by the recruiting company that she would be working in a chain store. But unfortunately, when she reached the UAE, she was given a cleaning job at the airport. And she had so many issues, of course. One of the issues was still the sexual harassment at work. And she mentioned a case of one of the sponsors who would always find her when she's cleaning the cabin, and she would harass her, she would touch her buttocks, and she would do what? And whenever she did, whenever she would ask, "Why are you harassing me?" she would respond with, "I'm sorry, the banana was standing," something like this. She tried to change the job, and she could not do it because the kafala system does not allow people to change jobs so easily. They need the permission of the sponsor, and if the sponsor, who is your employer, doesn't allow you to change jobs, then there is no way you are going to change the job unless you just want to go back. It is very, when the sponsor is himself abusive, when the sponsor is himself exploitative, how is he going to allow you to change a job? It is illogical.
One thing that's of interest to me is that she was promised a certain kind of work when she came to the UAE, but when she got here, she was given a completely different kind of work. It makes me think that the sponsor didn't own the place of her employment, but was maybe someone whose job was to provide work to other companies, to provide workers to, like, a temporary service or something like that. What? How does that work? Can your sponsor be someone whose business is simply to have employees that other people hire out, or how does it work?
The recruitment system in most of the Gulf countries is rigged with deceptions. Most of the people who are employed in, especially as cleaners or what, they are always deceived when they are leaving their countries. Actually, what happens is that these recruitment companies, they need a lot of money to have someone go to the UAE. And at the same time, they'll take money from the sponsor himself. And in countries like Uganda, few people can raise that amount of money that is being asked by recruitment companies. So for a few people who can, they are the kind of people who have gone to school, who have some education. Those are the kind of people who can get this what kind of money for the recruitment. And these are the people who have other aspirations. They have gone to school and they are professionals in different character. But the kind of deals that the recruitment company has is for cleaners. So they don't care. If they pocket their money, they don't care when they take you with your university degree and you work as a cleaner in some Arab home or in some supermarket or even in any other business in the UAE or in Qatar. It's none of their business. So it's still, and in the other way, it also hurts the migrant, because sometimes the migrant reaches in Dubai and they are indebted with the employer, the sponsor. The sponsor says that, look here, I bought you. I paid a lot of money to bring you from Uganda and to bring you from India, to bring you from Sri Lanka to come and work for me here. So you have no way, you cannot go. Even if you don't want this job, you have to work. Even if you are educated, you have to clean my house, you have to do this and this and this. And there is no way the person can get out of it because the passport is already confiscated. So it's like he's already imprisoned. He's trapped into this system, yes.
Even if he or she had the passport, they might not be able to afford to fly back to Uganda or wherever they came from.
Yes, in some countries they need an exit permit. That is what I was saying, that you need a sponsor's permission to do anything. In countries like Qatar, you need an exit permit. So your sponsor employer has to accept that you go back to your country. If he doesn't accept, you'll have to stay.
So it sounds like to me that there are two parties involved in getting people into the UAE under the kafala system, which one would be a kind of a middleman recruiter, someone who is going to find you and offer you work, and then the other person is the actual employer, and that person is the sponsor, not the recruiter. But is it often the case that you're not really in communication with your sponsor until you arrive?
That is right. You are not in communication with your sponsor until you arrive, because the middlemen, they are the ones who are recruiting, and they cannot give you the contact for the sponsor or your employer because they are taking money from him. As they are taking money from you, they are also taking money from him. They take money from you for visa, they take money from you for air ticket, they take money from you for recruitment, they take money from you for medical care, they take money from you for so many things, and it is a lot of money. It is a fortune. And when you go to the sponsor, they have also taken same money from the sponsor also. They have taken money for air ticket, they have taken money for visa, they have taken money for the medical care, they have taken money for recruitment and everything from the sponsor himself. So without your knowledge, when you arrive in this house, you are already in debts. You paid the money when you are in your country, home country, whether Sri Lanka or Uganda, you paid. But when you arrive in the UAE, still you are in debts. This man has paid, this sponsor of yours has paid some money to that recruiting agent. The problem is that all the governments, they are not interested in investigating this. For example, the case in Uganda now, it is very common that we have almost 50 recruitment companies. That is too much for a small country like Uganda. And all of this, they are announcing heaven on all radio stations. It is one of the most lucrative businesses now, shipping people from Uganda to Gulf Arab countries. And they are doing all this at this level of exploitation. The government doesn't care at all to investigate why these people are being double-charged. Why are they being charged? In Arab countries, there is now a change of law that it is the sponsor that is supposed to meet these what charges. It's the sponsor that is supposed to pay the air ticket, the sponsor that is supposed to pay the visa and everything. This knowledge is not available to the migrants. So the migrants, when they arrive there, the sponsor, oh, fine, he pays because the law requires him to pay, and he pays to the recruiting agent. But when this migrant is in his house, he will ask for this money back. He will say, I'm going to deduct from your salary every month this amount because I'm recovering my money. That is right. You are being enslaved. That's the clear way to say it. The issue is that you are being enslaved. If you are working and working so hard and you are not earning any money, that is slavery.
Back to Harriet. So she was working in terrible circumstances. And at that time, I don't want to talk about her really, I guess, specifically or personally, but when you were describing her story, one thing that you mentioned was that many women who would end up in these positions where they were underpaid, abused, harassed, and living in unhygienic conditions, in order to get away and improve their circumstances, some would turn to prostitution as a solution.
Yes.
In a situation where the men and women both are sexually starved, they're separated, who would such a worker turn to as a prostitute? Was she turning to tourists or people like her? Were they turning to tourists or to Arabs or to other workers, foreign workers in the UAE under the kafala system?
In most of the Gulf countries, actually, prostitution is almost institutionalized from the government itself, because when you provide no opportunity for other people, the only way to satisfy their sexual desires is through prostitutes. And that is why the country is quite lenient when it comes to dealing with the prostitute thing, because they have this feeling that this is the only way the people we have starved for so long, they can satisfy their egos. And the women mostly who are abused from work, actually, one of the police officials from Sharjah one time, he told us that the domestic workers, housemaids, was the leading recruiter of prostitutes. Most of the prostitutes from these poor countries, they first work as housemaids, and once they are abused, then they have to go out on their own and find a job as prostitutes in brothels, in pubs, and everywhere. And their clients are diverse as well. Of course, some of the clients are these migrant workers, the poor migrant workers. If you are going to areas in Dubai, areas like Naif and the Sabaha and all this at night, you'll find that migrants say on days like Friday, they stretch lines. They are staying in very long queues, and they are all waiting to go into a house, a brothel, of only one or two women to have sex, and then they go back to their work. And such a kind of sex is actually very cheap. It could go even to dirhams, 20 dirhams, or even 30 dirhams. That is about $10. They also, in nightclubs, they also target tourists. Of course, tourists, they are also the big clients to the prostitutes. And even the local Arab people still, they are big clients to the prostitutes. Yes.
Well, let me ask you about your work as a journalist in Dubai. How long were you with The National?
I was with The National for 6 years.
And in what capacity? Were you a writer or as an editor or both? Or
I worked with The National for 6 years. I was a reporter, mostly doing the Northern Emirates. At first, I used to do all the four Emirates, Ras Al Khaimah, Umm Al Quwain, Ajman, and Sharjah, and even Fujairah, the five Emirates. And subsequently, someone was recruited to do Ras Al Khaimah and Fujairah, and I was responsible with Ajman, Sharjah, and Umm Al Quwain. I was doing mostly local stories.
And who was reading that, and where was it distributed?
It is distributed in the whole of UAE, and the readers are diverse. Mostly, there are other English newspapers like the Gulf Today, Khalij Times, where I worked earlier, and the Gulf Today, I also worked there earlier, and also Gulf News. They all have different readership, of course. The National, it is mostly read by people from Europe and the foreigners from Europe and the US and what. Khalij Times, they have most of their readers from the Indian subcontinent, but it's also an English newspaper. And the same with the Gulf News, also they have most of their readers from the Indian subcontinent.
Is there a racial divide in the workers who are under the kafala system? I mean, I know that if you are from the United States, it's easier for you to get into the UAE, for instance. But if you want to work there, you still have to find a sponsor and be part of that system. I guess my question is, were you writing for other people like yourself who were living under those circumstances when you were writing for that paper or not?
I was trying to write for some people, of course. And the first question, I understood it as if there is a racial divide. Of course, the racism is an issue in the UAE. And even when it is in employment, professional jobs like this, you'll find that if you are from Africa, you will have to earn less than your counterparts in other regions. And always at the high level, it is always the people from British and USA, they are always earning higher than even the Arabs themselves. Mm-hmm. Then the Arabs come in the second place. Then after the Arabs, then you'll find the other national, even the Arabs, they are the classes. The Arabs from the GCC earn higher than Arabs from Egypt or Syria. Then from that, you'll have the other classes, maybe the Filipinos and Indians and the Africans will always be at the bottom. This does not, it is the same way even with professional jobs, and it doesn't matter what kind of work you are doing or what kind of qualifications you are having. The salaries are always structured based on your race and nationality.
In your case, it wouldn't matter how popular your work was with readers, say, if you had a regular column. Did you encounter censorship as a journalist at that paper? Were there things that you couldn't write about, or you were reports that you gave that were pulled, or what was that environment like?
Yeah, censorship was also another issue most in all the newspapers in the UAE. It starts with the self-censorship. You yourself, at first, you go for an event or something, you find, you come across a story and you know that even if I put this in the paper, even if I file this, it will never be published. Then the editors themselves, they have their own self-censure. So they have already set red lights on some stories, like you don't go. For the example, The National, we were not doing any suicide stories. We were not allowed to do suicide stories. The issue was that So most of the suicide stories or stories that we have labeled suicide, they had stories behind them. All suicide stories, they have stories behind them. And those stories were an issue. Some suicide stories, people were taking their lives because they were fed up with the exploitative system that had enslaved them in the UAE. And if you were to go into do such stories, sometimes there would be questions like, why are so many suicides in the UAE? And they were always making counts according to the English newspapers' stories. So many stories in the UAE. Why? Why so many suicide stories in the UAE? Why? So the editors came up and said, you know, we are not doing any suicide stories anymore. Even if you quote that, you know, this has happened and this incident was a suicide. The moment you mention suicide, they say, forget it. Just look for another story. Then it is also, even on the government scale still, there is censorship still. The government itself has a lot of hand in what is being published and what is not being published. They start with having to appoint the editors, the kind of editors they are appointing. They are actually not editors, they are censors, people who will know what is should be published and what should not be published. It doesn't matter what their qualifications. For example, in the National Way, they have an editor who has been working as a diplomatic something and something with no newspaper experience before. But his only credit is that he knows what the rulers know what should be published and what should not be published. That's his only credit.
The book that we're going to publish here in December, Slave States, is mostly going to be read, I think, in the United States and the UK. I mean, it will be distributed around the world.
Yeah.
For those readers and people listening to this podcast, what can people in the U.S. or the U.K. or in Europe do? And is there a movement that needs to be supported of the workers under the kafala system trying to overturn that system? What is going on politically and amongst the workers there to do something about these conditions and overturn them?
First of all, readers from the United States and the readers from the UK, now those two countries are now like the agenda setter when it comes to what is being done in these Gulf Arab countries. If they reject this kind of abuses and this, then there would be... If they reject this kind of treatment of migrant workers in these countries, there could be some change. These countries could be obliged. The first problem is that even in the United States and the United Kingdom, most of the media now, the media itself is so much into the sheikhs. They are so much interested in the lives of the sheikhs, partly because the sheikhs, they are the big donors to some of the newspapers. So it is even in these countries that stories of poor migrant workers, they are not so much popularly highlighted in the press from the United States or in the United Kingdom. And until these countries, which are leading in the media, until these countries come to highlight these stories, they will not be highlighted anywhere. So it's very important for these stories to be told in the United States. It is very important for these stories to be told in the United Kingdom. And it is very important for the media in these countries to pick up these stories, because if they don't pick up them up, they will not be picked up anywhere. They will be silenced. The thing is that I was saying that in media in this United States and the United Kingdom is not as free as it is. Should be when it comes to covering Gulf Arab country states. It is not as free because one of the things is that these rich, oil-rich countries, they are mostly the donors. They sponsor so many programs, even in newspapers and whatever. And the newspapers, they feel quite obliged to just throw in, to keep quiet about what is happening in these countries. Workers' unions are banned in the UAE, they are banned in Qatar, they are banned everywhere. And all the work that is being done, like I did, it was done voluntarily, and it is done on a smaller scale, of course. It is done on a scale that is not having even any publicity. So many people, they have put up their voices, and they would not find anywhere, any channel to put their voices out. And the only difference I had is that I could be able to write something like a book. If it is a story, it will still not find even so much audience where it could go and this kind of thing. So it's still a very big struggle for the migrants in these countries to find justice. It's really, really a very desperate struggle because the migrant worker can easily be silenced, of course. It's one thing that is very easy. It will be silenced and his voice will never be heard.
Well, I'm very proud to be publishing your book. Is there anything that I didn't ask you about that you wished I had asked you, or is there something more that you'd like to say here as we get to the end of this interview?
I have a feeling that we have exhausted most of the things that I would like to say. I'm very proud that you have reached out to Mr. Douglas, and I'm very grateful that you people accepted to publish my book. I hope that the book reaches out to so many people, and I hope that the book has a positive impact towards the migrants' rights in the UAE and in other Arab countries like Qatar, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia.